I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. I have seen a few famous paintings in my day. Honestly, just a few, I have to say. But the few I have seen, mostly in Germany and Austria, in places like Berlin, Munich, Vienna, elsewhere there. One painting I remember seeing with my own two eyes, and I must say it's among my favorites, a renowned painting in Vienna in the famous Belvedere Palace. It's a work by Gustav Klimt called The Kiss. A lot of people do like this painting. I'm not alone. Now, it's been 40 years since I stood there gazing at it, but I still remember the shock of wonder, intrigue, disorientation even, of suddenly standing right there before it, having seen images of The Kiss before in places like art history textbooks, in encyclopedia articles, coffee table books, those kinds of places. But there I was standing before it, and I had a lot to wonder about, including its history, its execution by the artist, the way it was acquired, who owned it actually, how did it land there at Belvedere? Not to forget, I was curious about its monetary value. Now, call me a rube, but are shiny paintings with a lot of gold in them worth anything more than dusky paintings with no gold? Flashy can be good. It's not necessarily an aesthetic plus, but gold is flashy, maybe even a little bit blingy, not as blingy as diamonds. So I was wondering about the value of this thing. Gold is definitely, if nothing else, an attention grabber. Well, another Gustav Klimt painting is sometimes called the Austrian Mona Lisa. This one is actually a portrait of a woman named Adele Bloch-Bauer, and this portrait has a lot of gold in the mix, too, probably even more gold as a percentage of the entire canvas than you're going to see in The Kiss. This lady in gold has quite a story, and today we're going to hear the backstory of how this piece of art isn't just attractive and compelling and opulent and painted by Gustav Klimt, but how it came into dispute as to the rightful owner. Wartime politics, art politics, and the sheer value of the thing all play into this tale. And maybe most importantly, we're going to learn about how the final decision about who had an actual legal claim to it set something of a precedent. You could call this a domino effect of art restitution. By the way, we are talking about a painting, This Lady in Gold, that sold in 2006 at auction for $135 million, at that time a historic high for any painting. Anne-Marie O'Connor is with us. O'Connor is a veteran foreign correspondent and culture writer currently living in London. Her award-winning book, The Lady in Gold, The Extraordinary Tale of Gustav Klimt's Masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer, was published back in 2012. Anne-Marie O'Connor, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you for having me.
So just to begin with, is this painting, The Lady in Gold, in a private collection today?
No, actually, now this painting is at the Neue Gallery in New York City. One of the provisos of the sale was a stipulation that the painting would be on public view.
That wasn't always the case. I understand at the time of the auction, was there not some fear that this would just kind of be hidden somewhere?
When the auction happened, there was a lot of fear, even among the family that was allowing the paintings to be sold. Some of the heirs were afraid that the paintings would disappear into private collections, and some of them did. But the portraits of Adele Bloch-Bauer, the gold portrait that's so famous, and a second one, which was bought by Oprah Winfrey, although we didn't know that at the time, the portraits were in public view at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and at the Neue Gallery. The landscape paintings, there were three landscapes, disappeared into private collections. And that was a source of some sadness among the heirs. But then a few years later, in some exhibitions, the paintings reappeared because the people who bought them also felt like they should be on private exhibition, and allowed them to be borrowed for the shows.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a good, that's a happy ending in a way, because I'm apprehensive about these auctions when they happen, because so often there's anonymity as to the buyer, as you alluded. We didn't know about Oprah Winfrey at first, for instance, but this is a different world that most of us don't get to be in.
Well, that's the big hazard of these restitutions, because so much time has passed, and the people who are holding these paintings illegally, and in most cases, these institutions knew or looked the other way, they waited so long to carry out the restitution. So a lot of people were gone, and they had young heirs, and it was difficult to have any other solution than selling them. But having said that, thankfully, a lot of the people who bought these paintings and buy restituted paintings understand that these paintings are patrimony, because many of them are masterpieces, and they understand the need to allow these cherished icons to be put on public view.
Yeah. Well, how much of this story gets conflated or tied up in, entangled with the story of World War II?
Well, it's really all about World War II. You know, I was in Los Angeles, and like you, I had seen this painting when I was a teenager. And I was told in art school that it was a decadent society woman. And I was reading a small community newspaper in Los Angeles, and I saw a small item about a local woman whose family had had things stolen by the Nazis, which was very common in Los Angeles. And in those days, no one ever got anything back. But I kept reading, and there was a small image of a painting that was stolen, that was a painting of this woman's aunt. So I called up directory assistance, and I got Maria Altman's number, and she invited me over. And she opened her door, and she was just the most charming woman. And she said, "My darling, my love, it's a long story." And she told me the story of her aunt and her relationship with Gustav Klimt.
Now, let's go back to the decadence part. This is so interesting. Where did that begin? Because apparently this Adele was anything but decadent. She was educated. She was into philosophy. She was an intellectual. Not to say that these are mutually exclusive categories. An intellectual can become decadent, I suppose. But who was she?
Well, that was a misconception. The women that were painted by Gustav Klimt were Jewish women. They were Jewish intellectual women. They were patrons of art. They were patrons of Freud and many of the thinkers of that time. And they were intellectuals themselves. So Adele Bloch-Bauer was a philanthropist, a muse of Klimt, a friend of Klimt, and of many distinguished people. But the histories of these paintings were hidden because of the theft. After the Nazis stole them, they hid the identities of the women. So the whole story of who Adele was and the role that she played in this very glittering turn of the century Vienna was hidden also.
How did Maria Altman describe her aunt?
Oh, she said that she was a very intellectual woman. She was very cerebral. She wasn't interested in children. She didn't enjoy ladies' teas. She didn't like being a society lady. She wanted to be a serious player in the ideas and the events of her time.
So Gustav Klimt paints Adele. And this is years before World War II. In fact, Adele has passed on before the Nazis are on the scene, if I'm getting the chronology correct here.
Many years before. Adele died very young. And she was only 43 years old. She died a generation before the Nazis arrived. And her husband had this famous portrait in his home, and he turned her bedroom into kind of a shrine with the Klimt portraits of Adele and the other paintings by Klimt that she had collected with other modern art, because Adele was a supporter of the avant-garde. So when the Nazis came, Adele had long been gone from the scene.
And who is the first person or who are the first people to kind of do the smear thing and try to stain the character of any of these subjects of the Klimt paintings? Who is it? The Nazi aesthetic agenda that comes in and says this is bad stuff?
Well, Klimt was not declared a degenerate artist. And that it's a mystery why he wasn't, because just based on his erotic drawings alone. But the reason that he wasn't was because Balder von Schirach, who was the head of Hitler Youth and then became the Nazi leader in Vienna, was a huge fan of Gustav Klimt. And Balder von Schirach, during the war, went from house to house and stole with his staff the art collections of Jewish collectors who had Klimt works. And he put them all together in a 1943 exhibition that is still the biggest exhibition of Klimt's works ever. So he made this huge exhibition, and he sort of portrayed Klimt as this sort of Nazi Übermensch. And he was the key force in preventing Klimt from being declared a degenerate artist.
So degenerate artist is one thing, but at some point, again, who is it that's kind of hoping to put a stain on the character of any of this?
Well, the problem with the sort of Nazi pride that he was trying to push about Klimt, the problem with all of that was all of the people in his portraits were Jewish, and there were beautiful women, and they were being presented as these kind of icons in a Nazi era. So they had to hide their identities. So they didn't give their names. They gave no information about them. So the names of the paintings were things like Woman with Chinese Wallpaper, or in the case of Adele Bloch-Bauer, Dame in Gold, the Lady in Gold.
Yeah. Well, we're going to hear the story next from our guest of how some of these pieces of art end up in major institutions of art. I've already mentioned the Belvedere Palace as one location for Klimt works. But we're going to get right back into it after a short break here on the show as we visit with Anne-Marie O'Connor. Her award-winning book is titled The Lady in Gold, The Extraordinary Tale of Gustav Klimt's Masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We're talking about a painting often referred to as The Lady in Gold, and the book is titled, that we're talking about right now, The Lady in Gold, The Extraordinary Tale of Gustav Klimt's Masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer, and the author is with us, Anne-Marie O'Connor. Anne-Marie O'Connor, so during the Nazi time period, there's endless stories of how artworks were snatched up and confiscated and taken from Jewish families and such. And eventually, if you have a work by Klimt, and here's a famed Austrian painter, his works are going to be wanted there in Austria by the museums, I suppose.
Well, after the war, many of the owners of these paintings were dead. Ferdinand Bloch-Bauer, the husband of Adele, was still alive and trying to get back his paintings, including the portraits of his wife. But he died right after the war without achieving this. Now, the Nazis had taken these paintings for safekeeping and put them in castles all over Austria. And the portrait of Adele was in a southern castle. It was brought back to the museum. And many of the directors of the museums during the Nazi era stayed on after the war, or stayed on in more minor roles. And so they helped to put these paintings into the collections of the museums. And one of the things that they told people who came, family members asking for the paintings, was, no, your family donated this painting. So that's what they said about Ferdinand. They said that he donated the painting to the museum, which was the opposite of the truth. He died trying to get the paintings back.
And yet his efforts to get the painting back, or paintings in the plural, this, at least in terms of the Lady in Gold painting, this was not necessarily the wish of his deceased wife, Adele Bloch-Bauer. She had specified, had she not, that she wanted this to be seen in public in a museum?
The wishes of Adele at the time that she died were to be part of this effort by people like her to put these paintings in Austrian museums. Now, in those days, it was a real struggle to get modern art into the museums because the museums were very traditional. And so people who had these paintings often wanted them in the Belvedere. But the wishes of Adele to be part of this were contingent on Ferdinand wanting to donate at the time of his death. So the paintings were still the property of Ferdinand, and it was his final judgment in the end. So, of course, her husband, after he had been driven out of his country and his friends had been killed or hunted down or sent to camps, had no desire to donate these paintings to the museums. In addition, the paintings were supposed to have been donated if he wished after his death. And instead, they were dragged out of their houses with the paintings owned by other Jewish families while these people were still alive. So all of the terms of any proposed donation had been violated. So it was rendered null and void.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to Maria Altman and tell me, if you would, what is her story of leaving Europe?
Well, Maria left under tremendous duress. Her husband was immediately arrested and taken to Dachau. And at that time, a lot of her family left Vienna. And she was a beautiful young woman. She had to grow up very quickly. She was in her early 20s, and she had never had a job and had been the baby of the family. But she was very brave. So she chose to stay in Vienna and try to get her husband out of Dachau with the help of his older brother. And she stayed until it was a dangerous time and they were starting to arrest and deport people. But somehow her brother managed to negotiate a release of Maria's husband, Fritz. And he came home. And what was being done was they were extorting from Jewish families. So they didn't want to let him out. He came home under house arrest. And they were allowed to go out to the dentist and do errands, but they were supposed to stay home. And they had Nazi minders who were living in their building, keeping watch on them. So all of this was an effort to get property and wealth and signatures for possessions from these families. So basically they were being blackmailed in person. And so they made a plan. And one day they said they had to go out to the dentist and they went off. And instead they went to the airport and got on a plane and flew to a border city in Germany where someone was waiting to take them across the border at night into Holland. And they would have had to go across. Maria was in her dress and the barbed wire ripped her stockings. And there were border guards in a farmer's pasture where they could go across. And if they had been caught, they would have been arrested at the very least and possibly killed on the spot. So it was a very brave gamble and they made it to safety and after that flew to England.
Yeah. Well, you then meet her, actually. This is, again, the niece of the subject of the portrait, and you meet her. She's pretty well on in years by the time you meet her, and this gracious lady, and she, even with 90 years or so, she gets involved in the court efforts to find restitution here, to get that painting back.
Well, that was astounding that she even did that. When I met her, she was basically doing this from her kitchen, and I asked her, Maria, do you have a lawyer? And she said, Randy, I've known him since he was in diapers. And it was Randy Schoenberg, a very young attorney who looked like he just graduated from college. And his office happened to be nearby her house. So I drove over to his office on Bundy in Los Angeles. And he had this very passionate drive to, in some ways, to have a reckoning with the Austrians for what had happened to his family and for so many families that he knew. So he was waging this lawsuit without, he had a small, someone had given him a small office in a law firm, and he didn't have staff, and he had books piled from the floor to the ceiling, and he was, most legal experts that I consulted said they didn't think he could win. But I told my newspaper, the Los Angeles Times, I thought it was an interesting community story with community personalities. And I did a story on it, and he kept winning.
Yeah, he keeps winning. How long does it keep? I mean, this case lands with the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, the case went on for 8 years, and his first victory was in the federal court in Los Angeles. So Austria still refused to come to any type of settlement. And so they went to the Supreme Court, which accepted the case, which was very lucky for him. They went to the Supreme Court with a case over jurisdiction, whether this case could be tried in U.S. courts. Now, in Europe, it's very difficult to sue over paintings. If you have a Nazi-looted painting, you can say you bought it in good faith. But American courts were much more hospitable. So the last thing that Austria wanted was this painting and its dispute to go to U.S. courts. So Austria then, when Randy won in the U.S. Supreme Court, over the jurisdiction, Austria said, okay, we'll put together a panel, a legal panel, and we will we will come to terms with this and we'll make a judgment in Austria.
Yeah, well, that just seems like where's the international venue for arbitration over this ever? You know, I don't even know if in The Hague, an international court has anything to do with art cases.
No, they haven't been very good at solving these Nazi-looted paintings, which is a shame because 20% of the art in Europe was stolen. But so it was a big gamble for Randy, because why would he trust Austria to come up with a fair resolution? And when Maria heard his proposal, she just said to him, "You're crazy." But so they put together a panel of three jurists. And there was one jurist that was a real dark horse. He had been born in Germany, and no one knew much about him, but he was one of the premier experts in law in Austria at that time and had written a lot of textbooks. So I think Austria thought it was going to go their way. And they were shocked when the panel agreed to return the paintings and the portrait of Adele to the family.
At that point, there was no higher authority. It was signed, sealed, delivered. It had to happen then.
Well, both sides agreed to abide by the decision. And it's interesting, the Austrians afterwards, the Austrian lawyer who was opposing Randy, told me that he didn't think that that this case would have gone the way it had if the head of this panel hadn't been this dark horse who happened to be born in Germany. He had been a naturalized Austrian. And I asked him, why do you think that? And he said, because Austrians only believe that they have guilt during the Nazi era if they did something bad or they killed someone or something. Whereas Germans believe in collective guilt. And that's why he thought that this jurist swung the vote Maria's way.
Now, this case, once it's been decided, has a remarkable ripple effect in the art world. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, really, this just sent a chill through European museums. And immediately, a museum in Holland agreed to give back more than 200 paintings in a collection in a similar case that they had been sitting on for years. And I think that they took a look at the Black Bauer case and they thought, okay, we can hold out and be dragged through the slime and the mud and lose, or we can just agree to restitute the paintings now. So I think it had a huge impact on European museums, and suddenly a lot of paintings were restituted to families. And in the end, Austria became one of the forerunners who restituted the most paintings of in Europe. And they ended up restituting, I think, 14 Gustav Klimt paintings, and they were masterpieces.
Yeah. Now, Maria Altman, does she live long enough to see the conclusion of this case?
She did live long enough. And I went to the auction with Maria. And I think that for Maria, this was a very emotional reckoning because a lot of people who went through Nazi occupation had a lot of post-traumatic stress. And they had feelings that could never be resolved about friends who had been killed or who had died or even taken their own lives during the Nazi period. And so I think for Maria, this whole, and for many Americans who were watching this in Los Angeles and other places, this whole case was a real catharsis where they felt like, okay, our team won. Because the truth is that most property that was stolen by the Nazis was never returned.
What do you think the very long-term effects of this precedent are going to be?
Well, I think that it has made European museums more amenable, and we continue to see restitutions occurring now to this day. I think that it has given people an understanding of Gustav Klimt they never had before. Gustav Klimt was portrayed as a loner or sort of a society painter. And very little was really known about him before this case. And now we know that he was part of this very brilliant time in Vienna as a participant and not just as a courtier.
What do you make finally of that price tag at the auction? $135 million at the time. I understand it was a historic high for art at auction. What those dollar figures after a certain, you know, I figure after 40 million, what's the point, you know?
Well, you know, these figures are the art market now has basically become sort of a repository of investment money for people. And I think that's a shame. But in this case, it wasn't just a restitution of art. It was a restitution of history. And I think that's what it took to teach this lesson to everyone about this unfinished business of the past.
Such a remarkable story, and your efforts have been very important in documenting this with your book, of course, on the topic. A pleasure to have a chance to visit with you about it. Anne-Marie O'Connor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anne-Marie O'Connor with us. She's a veteran foreign correspondent and culture writer, and the book we've been talking about titled Lady in Gold, The Lady in Gold, The Extraordinary Tale of Gustav Klimt's Masterpiece, Portrait of Adela Bloch-Bauer.
The Lady in Gold is such a stunning painting. Really, no mystery why the Nazis stole it. The Viennese were loath to part with it, and the family fought to get it back. We'll explore a few more twisted and gripping stories about great art when Constant Wonder returns in just 1 minute. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Forget linear perspective and chiaroscuro. Let's get the stories behind the masterpieces. Maybe Van Gogh was murdered and didn't commit suicide after all. Who was the woman who pushed Norman Rockwell in a more political direction? To get the stories behind some great art pieces, Marcus Smith spoke with Jennifer Dassel. She's the curator of modern and contemporary art at the North Carolina Museum of Art. She's also the creator and host of the podcast Art Curious and the author of Art Curious, Stories of the Unexpected, Slightly Odd, and Strangely Wonderful in Art History. Let's join their conversation with the highly improbable story about how the CIA once poured funding into abstract expressionism. No kidding. It had something to do with persuading people in the developing world that freedom in the West was more fun than what communism was offering.
And it was a classified CIA mission. It actually happened, and it wasn't until the 80s and 90s that that story became more widespread. But even then, it's still not totally widely known. But that's exactly what happened. You're right. What happened was during the Cold War, we were, of course, as a nation, trying to promote ourselves as having the capabilities for freedom in all aspects of life. And that, to many people, included freedom of expression in art as much as anything else, not just freedom of speech, but being able to create a work of art that could look any way you wanted it to. So there was no propaganda behind it. There was no storytelling that was for the glory of the state, for example. And if you wanted to paint a splash of red paint and that be it, that was considered the ultimate in freedom. And that was something that was very much not looked upon kindly and in places like the USSR. And so the idea was that there were these small sections of the CIA that were called the short leash policy holders. And they kept at this distance of about 2 to 3 people or 2 to 3 organizations. They would keep the artists from actually knowing where their artwork was going. And so they would have museums and other cultural institutions come together, secretly say that they were backing an exhibition, for example, in Paris or in London. But it was actually all completely bankrolled by the CIA trying to bring these exhibitions all around the world so that people could see an example of American art and its greatness and therefore understand that that greatness came not at the cost of creativity and freedom.
Name me an artist who got involved here.
Jackson Pollock, for sure. And same with other people like Mark Rothko and Helen Frankenthaler. But the funny thing was that the artists did not know, because they had no clue that their work was being used in this covert way. They thought that their work was being taken around the world for legitimate art exhibitions. And they were legitimate art exhibitions. It was just that they were not necessarily run or organized by the museums themselves, but were done so at the behest of the government.
Do you think this worked?
That is an excellent question. I don't know for sure if it did, but one thing that I always come back to is not necessarily whether it worked to fight the Cold War, but what it did to actually impact abstract expressionism. Because the art world prior to the 1950s really was based in Europe, especially in Paris. And then all of a sudden at mid-century, the whole world's eyes turn to New York and it becomes the center of the art world then. And really everybody points to the abstract expressionists as being the reason why that change occurs. And then I think about people like Jackson Pollock, who were popular within some artistic circles, but not hugely outside of them, and certainly not from, you know, the everyday Joe in America at that point. And yet he became hugely important and influential during his lifetime, and so much so that even after his death, only a year or two after he died, places like the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York had begun collecting his works. And the Met is wonderful, but it's also a little bit of a cultural stalwart in that it's not the most avant-garde, I suppose, in its collecting. And yet they were very early on collecting Pollock. So I have to think that their enthusiasm and the general quickness of abstract expressionism's growth has to be due to the fact that it had this covert backing and more exposure that way.
So abstract expressionism was something not welcome under communist regimes?
Exactly. Under communist regimes, there was more interest and more proposed, I suppose you could say, just general more backing for artists who were working under something called socialist realism. So these were really more propagandistic works of art that were meant to show the socialist governments within this positive light. So you have a lot of scenes of happy workers, for example.
I would never have thought of a Jackson Pollock painting with splattered paint here and there on a canvas looking quite random. I would never have thought of that as being a vehicle for very covert and sly political messaging and kind of appropriated by the U.S. government.
Me neither. I think it seems, especially on the outset, to be so random. And I don't think Jackson Pollock would have been very happy about it either, because a lot of those same artists who they ended up using as part of this covert project were really kind of anti-government, and in some cases, even socialist or communist themselves. So it's this real disconnect. But it's really funny. Apparently, it seemed like a good idea, so they went forward with it.
I want to jump to another wickedly good story you tell that has to do with grave robbing or taking corpses. And this was from what time period? And you set the record straight about what was really going on.
Yes. So this is actually a chapter that I began writing, planning to write it as me learning the truth about what I had already carried with me and discovering that it was an actual myth, which was that when I was coming up in art history, we were taught that artists during the Renaissance, so a lot of the big name people like Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo and Titian, these big name artists in art history, were unable to really learn about how the human body functioned and appeared because dissection and anything anatomical was really off limits. And the idea was that in order to really accurately create an image of the human body or a sculpture of the human body, you needed to know how it worked, and that was including everything underneath the skin. So you could, for example, have a model come into your artist studio and you could sketch them, but you can't really look and see what their muscles look like. And so the idea was that these artists would then rob graves or, in some cases, very extreme, even kill people so that they could take them back and do these covert anatomical discoveries. And I learned actually very recently that that is a complete myth, and that even more interesting is that not only was it allowed or of interest for them to do that, and by no means was it this dark secret, but that places like the Catholic Church even had interest in them doing so. So it not only wasn't this dark secret, it was something that was actually supported during this time of great learning and interest in the human body.
So there would be facilitation from people on the church's side of things to help artists get their hands on cadavers?
Somewhat. And what's interesting is that it seems to really support the church as well, because if you think about if you visited any church in Europe, big or small, they usually have something that's called a reliquary. So it's even in some cases a part of a body of a saint or something belonging to a saint. So thinking about it in that light, it makes sense that the church would want people to be doing dissections and these studies, because if not, where would they be able to get their reliquaries, for example? The idea that the church was against it was actually something that was formulated as a pure thought in the 19th century, that the body was, of course, made by God, so therefore to do anything to harm it, even doing a dissection, would then be a grave sin. And that turns out that that was not at all the thought during the Renaissance.
So somebody later came along and badmouthed them.
Exactly. From what I read, to me it seems like one of those moments where you make something up in order to say how much more advanced or forward-thinking you are in this time in terms of your moralistic aspects. So during the 19th century, when there was a large Christian revival, people were saying, oh, yes, this is definitely the way it's always going to be with people. We should never do dissections. And if there was any way to prove that wrong, you would be able to say, oh, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 500 years ago, they had things wrong and had things different.
We've got with us right now Jennifer Dassel. She is the creator and host of the podcast Art Curious, and now the book Art Curious, Stories of the Unexpected, Slightly Odd, and Strangely Wonderful in Art History. We're going to take a short break here on Constant Wonder and then come back to Jennifer Dassel. I want to know if she's going to weigh in on, was Van Gogh murdered or was it a suicide? Which do you believe and why? Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. We've got a topic right now that's just so well suited for our show. We're visiting with Jennifer Dassel. She is creator and host of the podcast Art Curious. And that podcast now reflected in a book with the same title, Art Curious, the subtitle Stories of the Unexpected, Slightly Odd, and Strangely Wonderful in Art History. What a wonderful way to get into art history. You make it, Jennifer, so approachable. It's not, you know, in the hallowed halls of somebody's museum. It just comes right out, and you just kind of lay out the stories there in ways that are gripping. And I want to talk about, of course, I said it just a few moments ago, I want to talk about Van Gogh. Murdered or a suicide?
I love it. This is a topic that really came to the forefront a little less than 10 years ago. Two Pulitzer Prize-winning authors put together what they considered to be the definitive biography of Van Gogh. It's called Van Gogh, The Life. And very, very interestingly enough, in a small part of an appendix in the back of their book, they stated that they had an alternative theory about Van Gogh's death. And long story short, it involves a young teenager from Paris whose family summered in the place where Vincent Van Gogh died, a small town called Auvers-sur-Oise, which is about 30 kilometers north of Paris, and that he had this Wild West obsession, and he fancied himself a little bit of a cowboy, and he had a pistol that he had acquired that worked very erratically, and he also seemed to be a little bit of a bully, and Van Gogh was one of the people he most frequently tormented. And so these two authors, their names are Gregory White Smith and Stephen Nafe, went through just huge outpouring of numbers of letters and eyewitness testimonies and so forth, and basically came to the confusion that there was some kind of kerfuffle between this boy and the artist, and that they don't know for sure if it was an accident or an intention to murder him, but that is how Van Gogh actually died, instead of being the story that we all have heard about Van Gogh, which is that he committed suicide in 1890. So it's a really interesting tale, and in some ways it does actually help with some of the things that we don't actually have proof of, or things that we've supposed about Van Gogh's death, which is, for example, the idea that for the longest time no one was able to actually locate the revolver that Van Gogh supposedly used, that was then later, in theory, possibly discovered. And as recent as last year, actually, again, in theory, no one knows for sure if this is the actual weapon, but a supposed weapon went up for sale in auction in Paris last year. And a lot of these really interesting details in some ways do make some sense, but for me, I have to say, it's a really far-fetched story. It's far more interesting in some ways, but I think if you look more at Van Gogh's life, I think the traditional tale still makes a lot of sense to me.
And that has to do with his mental state, his emotional state.
Exactly, exactly. So just thinking about not only that famous incident of him lopping off his ear, but even just looking at things like his letters to his brother, who was really his closest friend, that he constantly was talking about the despair that he felt and his various mental illnesses. So it seems like it's not too far of a stretch to understand that he might have had the idea to take his own life in a fit of despair.
Well, I want to shift gears now and with you talk about somebody who is so innocuous, so harmless, so undramatic in some ways that you'd think he couldn't even achieve fame unless you do something horrific in life as an artist and you know, make a big splash. And yet this guy is known throughout America as one of the icons of, should I say, illustration? Norman Rockwell? Was he a painter? Was he an illustrator, this Norman Rockwell?
Oh, that's such a good question. And I know this is one of those delineations that infuriates people. He was a painter. He legitimately painted canvases, and those canvases would then be translated into covers for the Saturday Evening Post.
Yeah. And, you know, I like Charles Schultz and I like Norman Rockwell, and I think of them both as artists, and yet some people feel like you got to have more of an edge.
I totally agree, and I'm with you. I also love both of them. But I'm with you. It's a lot of people feel like if you're just, they call it, you know, just illustration, and that is such a negative way to look at things. And his work is so iconic and so meaningful in pop culture and art history as much as anything else. And so he deserves a lot of credit that some institutions only recently have started to really give to him as an artist.
Well, let's do talk about his contribution in matters that, actually do bump up against what in his day was, and even today, is still incredibly important, the civil rights. He wasn't exactly outspoken, but he wasn't silent either.
No, and what's really interesting is that in the late 1950s and early 60s, he decided to leave this cushy position at the Saturday Evening Post, which is really where he spent the entirety of his career. It was close to 50 years he was there as their predominant illustrator, and that was the job that made him famous. And at this, during the point at which civil rights movement was starting to really build up in the U.S., he was married to his third wife, who was very progressive and really started pushing him in a more liberal direction. And his goal with his illustrations for the Saturday Evening Post was to show these gentle images of life as it was. And he started really saying, there's a disconnect here between what I actually read about in the newspaper, what I am actually seeing in cities and in my own neighborhoods, and what I'm being asked to make for the Saturday Evening Post. And so he stepped away and left his job there and took a position instead at Look magazine, which was really so much more progressive at the time. And it was all about the image. So I kept thinking, what better place could someone whose job it is to make images could go to than getting a job at Look magazine?
Is it true that he was under pressure while at the Saturday Evening Post, while providing them with those covers, he was under pressure to depict a privileged white class society and to depict black people in more subordinate stations in life?
Absolutely. And it was sort of an open secret, was that they, at the Saturday Evening Post, they expressly said that he could not show any African Americans or anyone else in a more diverse light unless they were in that subservient position. So if you think about works that he did where he has a train manager, someone in the background who's African American, he did his best to show them in as positive or joyful a light as possible. But eventually, I think his conscience caught up to him and said, you know, I can't do this anymore. And that was one of the reasons he left.
I think, I didn't know we'd have time for this, but we do. And I just think it's such a wonderful thing to talk about the Mona Lisa. You notice how I use the? It's not Mona Lisa, it's the Mona Lisa. there's something about this painting that just begs for us to explain it away, or explain her smile, or talk about some kind of something bad about it, like it being stolen, or it's a fake, or all of it. What is the draw to this one painting that makes people talk about it over and over again in so many different ways?
Oh my goodness, that's another good question. I think part of it is because she's become the most famous work of art in the world. And for me, what's really interesting is that I don't think it's so much because the work of art itself is fantastic. It is, don't get me wrong, it is an important work, but I don't think it's the best painting ever created in the whole world. It's not even one of my favorites of Leonardo da Vinci's few paintings. But for me, it became really famous partially because of what happened to it in 1911, which was that it was very famously stolen. And only up to a few decades prior to that theft was she really gaining recognition as this big and monumental, in terms of importance, not in size, painting, because she was considered one of the many treasures at the Louvre, but there was no reason to really identify her as being the most important, the iconic image that we really think about her as today.
Now, I wanted to talk, I had an ulterior motive here, actually. I wanted to talk about Mona Lisa because, yeah, you rightly say she's like the most famous painting there is, right?
Yes.
There is this thing about art history where I think artists are privileged who are the great celebrities. who are the heroes who do epic work or at least are game changers, and their names go down in history. What do you do with all of the folk art and the unsigned works and the anonymous works and the stuff that just might be in a local museum that has tremendous merit and yet people overlook it? Is there a way to recalibrate our hearts vis-a-vis the art world and start seeing art that isn't signed by some famous person who's going to make millions from it?
I love that, and I absolutely think there is a way. And partially, I think it comes down to a couple of things. First is that if you find a work of art and you don't know a lot about it, read up as much as you can. Or if you can find anything on just a piece in your local collection, just go and admire it. I always tell people that it's not necessarily important that you can rattle off a list of names and dates. It's not necessarily important that you understand what you think the work is about. I just want you to look at it. For me, that's the real mind-blowing game changer, is just if you go and you find something and you look and you say, you know, I like the way that that artist drew that horse in that picture. That is enough, because that can transform and that can create a connection between you and this piece. And all of a sudden, you have something that really means something to you. So I would say tell people to just go and look and enjoy a work in whatever way makes sense for you. And then if you are able to do further reading or research, that's bonus to me.
Jennifer Dassel there, speaking with Constant Wonder host Marcus Smith. Dassel is curator of modern and contemporary art at the North Carolina Museum of Art. She's also the creator and host of the podcast Art Curious and the author of Art Curious, Stories of the Unexpected, Slightly Odd, and Strangely Wonderful in Art History. For a business enterprise that lasted less than 18 months, the Pony Express left an outsized mark on the American imagination. Tomorrow on Constant Wonder, we'll learn more about what the Pony Express did and why its life was so short. Thanks for joining us today on Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.